Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening. Welcome to the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Lodo. Thank you so much for coming out tonight. We really appreciate you coming to our author events and supporting independent bookstores. It is truly an honor to introduce one of the finest award-winning authors of our time, Thomas McGuane, who will talk about his newest novel, Driving on the Rim. He has also published short story collections, nonfiction, and five produced screenplays, including the wonderful film and one of my favorites, Tom Horn. And in 2000, he was named Denver's Evil Companion, which is still on our wall over here, which is a Denver Public Library and local writers group event, if you aren't familiar with it. He lives with his family on his Montana ranch, where he raises cattle and cutting horses. Driving on the Rim is a story of I. Burl Pickett, who is a doctor, who grows up and, he becomes a doctor in Montana, and from his rug-cleaning parents to his holy roller patriotic mom, and women in all age groups who try to seduce him, to the doctor who put him through school, we find out that Burl has lived a rather colorful life. When tragedy strikes in his practice, his way of life is upended. But it's also a story of Burl coming to terms that while life varies, the land around him is constant. And McGuane writes the land as a character, and it is the one thing that grounds us all. It is a pleasure to read anything he writes, but I truly enjoyed this book because after living in a small western town for 14 years, I could laugh and cry and nod and shake my head at some of these characters because I knew people like them. So please welcome the only member of the Academy of Arts and Letters who is also in the National Cutting Horse Association Hall of Fame, Thomas McGuane.
Thank you very much. I had my Costco experimental hearing aid here that I was going to try out, which I've used in crowded restaurants. But if I'll put them back in if I can't hear you when we do the question and answers later. I did an interview with Weekend Edition last Sunday, and the first question that Leanne Hansen asked me, she said, is this protagonist a romantic or a horn dog? And I said, I wish I knew. She said, is it you? I said, absolutely not. So, I've been doing this for a long time, and only lately have I been wondering how I got started at this. And I've been kind of racking my brain, and I think that my mother's capacity for remodeling the facts made me think that actuality was something that could be tampered with. I was never destined to be a photorealist, let me put it that way. But I remember when I was a kid, I grew up in a small town, and we lived about 4 or 5 miles outside of the town. And we went into town one day. I must have been 8 or 9 years old, and there were two dogs. There was this little street that had a one-pump gas station and a grocery store, and there were two dogs copulating in the middle of the street. And I couldn't understand what was going on. I said to my mother, what are they doing? And she said, well, the little one is sick, and the big one is pushing him to the hospital. So that got me thinking. Our town was on an island in Lake Erie, and there was a bridge over to the island, and I think it cost 25 cents for the driver to cross the bridge, and it was 25 cents a piece for every child over 10 or over 12. And my mother would drive us across the bridge when we were clearly over 10 or 12 or whatever it was. And she wouldn't pay the extra charge. And the bridge keeper would say, "Mrs. McGuane, those kids look well over 12 to me." And my mother would say, "Is it my fault that they worry?" And So anyway, I think it started with her. It was kind of interesting. My father went to Harvard and got a degree in English literature, and my mother went to some little podunk girls' school, name of which is long forgotten. And she was far better educated than my father. And both of them fancied themselves to be book people, but I got all my ambition from my mother, I think, really, because I do recall that books were just such an exciting thing to her. I mean, a new Saul Bellow would come out, and her new Norman Mailer, a new O'Hara would come out, and she was as wound up as though, there'd been a flying saucer landing in our backyard. And I remember one time she wrote Saul Bellow a letter, which I thought was, this is impossibly overweening, and she sent him off this letter and said, "You know, Mom, you can't, you know, this guy's busy." And he wrote back. It was amazing. I thought that's a model authors should reply. But in any case, whether or not I got a good start from my mother, it remains to be seen. The apple, in my view, always falls a long way from the tree, especially in the West, where our most sacred tradition is self-invention. You know, Frederick Jackson Turner said that the experience of the frontier made us into one race. And one of my passions as a writer is to prove that that's not true. I think the remarkable thing is how disparate and how separate our worldviews are in the American West, and that might in the long run be a good thing. We're very hard to organize, very hard to homogenize, and as I look at my 42nd year in a small Montana town, I'm persuaded that it's going to be chaotic forever. I'm going to read you just a little bit, just to give you a flavor of this, and then hopefully we can abandon ourselves to some kind of a conversation. I can get a little reciprocity from you all. That's what I really look forward to doing, and maybe you do too. This is kind of random. This isn't a collection of stories, so I've just got to take some stuff out of here that I think will give you a sense of what the book is like. Can you hear everybody hear me okay? That's great. Anybody want my Costco hearing aids back there? Fresh batteries? I was just telling something, if you've never tried them out before, the feeling that your shoes are chasing you around the room is something that takes some getting used to. An ordinary men's room gives you the sense that you're going over Niagara Falls in a barrel. So they're over there in my coat. We're not going to fool with them tonight. Oh, I'll give you the opening paragraph. This guy kind of tells you who he is. "My name is Burl Pickett, Dr. Burl Pickett, but I sign checks and documents I.B. Pickett, and this requires explanation. My very forceful mother, a patriot and evangelical Christian, named me after the author of God Bless America. So I am Irving Berlin Pickett and well aware of the absurdity of my name. My father wanted Lefty Frizzell Pickett, and that would have been worse. In any case, my very name illustrates the borrowed nature of my life, not easily denied. In fact, I've learned to enjoy my circumstances as I have moved among people trapped in their homes, their jobs, their families, and their names. My esteemed colleague, Alan Hirsch, mountaineer and cardiologist, calls me Irving with a chuckle. When I first arrived at our clinic from the Indian Health Service, Dr. Hirsch told me that I couldn't really call myself a physician until I had delivered babies to ambivalent parents or taught the old to accept their grotesque new faces. I don't know about that, but I do abide in the conviction that I've come a long way, and lately I've wondered how this all happened. My father had worked briefly as a pipe fitter for the Northern Pacific Railroad. In the course of corporate takeovers, the railroad had actually changed its name several times, but Northern Pacific was the one that stuck. It meant something. Burlington Northern meant nothing. Then he had a little stock farm he liked to call a ranch, whose main purpose was to let him keep horses, but he lost it to the bank and went to work for the post office. My mother was a hairdresser, and because of her big mouth and religious mania, she had enemies all over southwestern Montana and very few customers. During my childhood, they had a traveling rug cleaning business, and the three of us saw most of the West as we towed the steamer behind our van, an old-fashioned steam jenny with an oil-filled crankcase and a picture of a Vargas-type girl in black nylons emblazoned on its side. They were wonderful years, really. As an only child, I was all but homeschooled, then run back and forth between our house and the less fashionable of the two grade schools before going to the local high school, where I was anonymous, never having been allowed by my overprotective mother to learn a sport. My mother joined one Pentecostal church after another, followed by my father, whose skepticism evaporated in the heat of her enthusiasm. They stopped just short of snake handling, but I liked to fish. I'd fish where there was water, and I fished in ditches where there was no hope of success. I now understand that I was, for my age, a weirdly underdeveloped human being. Even my mother noticed my immaturity. She was always telling me to stop staring at people, but she had once given me a gift beyond price. Looking down at me when I was a little boy, she said, "You're an old soul. You've been here before." I was nearly middle-aged. Let me get some water. I was nearly middle-aged before I learned that my mother's hometown in Arkansas was not called, as my father had said, Crackeropolis. It was Ayers, Arkansas. When I figured this out, I then invested way too much time in analyzing my father's odd little satire. Was it contempt for my mother's origins? Probably he was just being funny, but I was not sure. I did a bit of research on Ayers and learned that it was the site of an annual slasher film festival held in a big old Art Deco movie theater that was in the Registry of Historic Buildings, otherwise a quiet soybean town peopled by farmers in dashboard overalls. Unwinding my mother's pointed remark to my father to the effect that the only good Indian was a dead Indian, I eventually grasped that it referred to his few droplets of Cree blood. My father always pretended to be of French-Canadian stock, but I'd heard from other relatives that they were originally mixed-race folk who worked the lime kilns after the buffalo disappeared. All those people went back and forth between here and Canada looking for work, and so got into the habit of saying they were French-Canadians as a way to avoid being called half-breeds. The war and generations of marriage evaporated that, turning that class of folk into garden variety Americans with slightly exotic names like mine. My full name, Irving Berlin Pickett, will never find its way into common usage. When I was in my teens, I bought a set of drums, a snare, a bass with a foot pedal, and a broad, handsome Zildjian cymbal. I didn't go far, much past Gene Krupa's Lyonnaise Potatoes and some pork chops, which I got off a 78 RPM record called Original Drum Battle, Gene Krupa and Buddy Rich, and at which I blasted for weeks out the window of my parents' house, exhibiting early and alarming antisocial tendencies aggravated by my rhythmless accompaniment. One day, the drum set was gone. "Where's the drums at?" I demanded of my parents, with a fierceness neither I nor they had ever seen. I was just back from school, close to going off the deep end, when they said, and I knew it was a lie, that they didn't know where the drums was at. A neighborhood tipster, one Mrs. Kugel, a member of the St. Andrew's Episcopal Church, and so an enemy of my parents in their holy roller ways, confided that my drums were in the dump. So they were. I stood on a winter day staring at them crushed among the DeSoto parts, shattered at lava lamps and sundry garbage, paper, and dry rot wood. I was alone with three crows. These drums had enabled me to dominate my household and substantial parts of our neighborhood without resort to either ideas or speech. I was practicing, I explained, to join a big band like that of Harry James, he of the screeching trumpet. This last detail was entirely strategic, as Harry James was known to me only as a favorite of my parents, who, with their big black vinyls treasured in original sleeves, sometimes fell into music-induced reminiscence of the war years, even to the point of dancing by candlelight while I presumably slept. Their necking during "You Made Me Love You" grossed me out, as it would have any youngster observing his parents and quite happy quite that way. I didn't want to join a swing band, whatever that was. I wanted to rule by noise, and in that I had succeeded until the day the drums vanished. Certainly my parents had made off with him. I am in no doubt about the great courage required to cross their only child, but their lives had become unbearable. When I was not drumming, I was playing drum battle from my room and down the stairwell. My father read his newspaper in the backyard. I now see with shame that our home was really not habitable. "I know you pinched him," said I, "the whole kit to get even with me. Where's he come up with this stuff?" my father asked my mother, the fingers of his right hand checking his shirt pocket for his old golds. "Can someone tell me?" She swung her head, staring at the floor. She said, "I don't know. Dad looked to her for your cue. He was a bit weak in situations like this, and he was fishing for a bailout." I went to my room, returning with a pair of Vic Firth No. 3 maple drumsticks. I then removed a roasting pan from the cupboard over the stove, and I went at it. Heretofore, no one had blinked, but this appalling racket soon brought them around, and my father swung an open arm in my mother's direction, authorizing her to speak. I stopped and awaited her declaration, which can be condensed. They couldn't take it anymore. I considered this report with substantial silence before I spoke in phrases cribbed from God knows where. I said, "From this blow, I foresee no recovery." I went to my room. Ours was a cheaply constructed house, thin-walled, inadequately heated and insulated, with variously missing or inoperable doors to finish off what might have passed for privacy. Thus, I was able to hear my mother and father repeat, with various intonations, my exit line through their snorting and thinly muffled guffaws. I greatly profited by this lesson. I didn't have an idyllic childhood, though it contained enough boyish pleasures, especially hunting and fishing. Then in later times, I tended to glamorize the Great Plains, especially when I was in medical school and during my internship when describing it to artificially elated mixed groups. We had a rather sardonic professor of neurology, Martin Chenoweth, a bachelor who liked to be around younger people on party nights hoping to meet women. I recall pouring out my love of the Great Plains to Dr. Chenoweth, afterwards wondering where this enthusiasm had come from, and after several drinks, challenging him to see past its grim, its dusty, oddly featureless expanses, its rutted, exploited visage, I asked him to see its hidden glory. He interrupted me, his small face sharp under thin, carefully combed auburn hair, and said, "It sounds to me like the men's room at Grand Central." Appalling and inaccurate as this remark might have been, it put an end to my feckless nostalgia about my place of origin, a place I had endured in a van containing a malodorous steam machine for cleaning rugs, with my shaky, anxious parents staring hopelessly through the windshield for signs of the next town. While most houses in those towns had no rugs, those that did were a long way from cleaning services, or so my father's rueful after-the-fact theory went. It proved just about the paltriest get-rich-quick scheme known to man, and we chased it for a half million miles, always discouraged, always broke, always mad at ourselves, and unconsoled by my mother's conviction that, quote, "the Lord don't give us more than we can handle." We usually rented well out in the town, where, as my mother put it, quote, "our screams can't be heard." Those little towns were always in touch with one another, and I think my parents wanted our arrival to be a surprise. I was never to find out what they were running from, but it couldn't have been much. Bad checks, too small to justify the gas need to run us down. My father was a handsome man with a dimple in his chin like Kirk Douglas's, and I remember at the end of his life my mother asking him, "Where do you think that dimple will get you now, Kirk?" His handsomeness and wandering had been a problem. If there was a speech from her with a theme in my memory, it was, "Keep it in your pants, Kirk." His real name was Bob. By calling him Kirk, Mother was invoking his rambling ways with lethal disapproval. In more understanding times, my mother said that the war had given him crazy ideas. They both run around when they were young, so everything was canceled except the language it endured with a life of its own until the very end, when she repented and prepared herself for what she called the great by and by. Forgiving my father for everything would only fortify her contentment. When I was 14, we moved into my Aunt Sylvie's large, clean, comfortable manufactured home, a trailer, in Orofino, Idaho. Sylvie, whose name derived from Sylvia, was around 40, had divorced, working as a paralegal for a water lawyer who stayed busy defending all the cases arising from the many dams in the Columbia headwaters. Sylvie was a good-looking and very shy brunette with wonderful amethyst eyes. She was almost too shy to talk, but very intelligent and so indispensable to her boss that people said he would be ruined if she quit. The most notable thing about Sylvie, belied by her meek exterior, was her tigerish sexual appetite. And yet my parents trusted me with her while they were out shampooing rugs. It was a big mistake. I'll leave you at that. We can chat about it. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.